Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series, and for anyone there who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep and far-reaching public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a key role in helping human beings rise to meet our current challenges, to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. This is a part of that series of remarkable conversations on this topic. I've spoken with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. Today, I'm joined by Joanna Macy, and we're going to continue that discussion in a conversation entitled The Work That Reconnects Us. The way this will work is I'll introduce Joanna, and we'll spend about an hour having a real conversation, a living exploration of this topic, and then I'll make some announcements. And we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions, and then we'll finish up in about 90 minutes or a little longer. Joanna Macy is a world-renowned scholar and philosopher of Buddhism, general systems theory, and deep ecology. A highly respected voice in the movements for peace, justice, and the environment, she interweaves her scholarship with 5 decades of activism. As the root teacher of The Work That Reconnects, she has created a groundbreaking theoretical framework for personal and social change, as well as a powerful workshop methodology for its application. Her wide-ranging work, recorded in a dozen books and hundreds of seminars all over the world, addresses psychological and spiritual issues of the nuclear age, the cultivation of ecological awareness, and the fruitful resonance between Buddhist thought and contemporary science. Her work helps people transform despair and apathy in the face of overwhelming social and ecological crises into constructive, collaborative action. It brings a new way of seeing the world as our larger living body, freeing us from the assumptions and attitudes that now threaten the continuity of life on Earth. She lives in Berkeley, California, near her children and grandchildren. What I especially appreciate about Joanna is that she has for years been a leader in the deep inner work that makes soulful evolutionary activism really possible. Early on, her courageous example and influence led many of us to face and feel our pain about the state of the world and the environment. And she's also helped thousands of people see through the false dichotomies that prevent us from perceiving the complexity and paradox and the interconnectedness that pervades all these important issues. She's serious in the richest and deepest sense of that word. And she's been a source of soulful depth. So thus, her work has really contributed a great deal to the consciousness with which I framed the animating question of this whole series. So in addition to respecting you tremendously, Joanna, I'm really grateful for how you've advanced the evolution of human culture. So welcome. I'm really delighted to have you on the program today.
Thank you for having me join you.
Yeah. Well, in previous conversations on this series, I and the listeners have looked pretty seriously at the interconnected, enormous crises of our world. And most of these teleseminar conversations have looked squarely at how we can engender a cultural transformation, what you have called the Great Turning. So today I'm interested that we plunge right into looking at the work that reconnects. Is that okay?
I love that.
Great. Well, you know, I so appreciate that you see this process beginning with the foundation for all sanity, basic gratitude, a felt sense of wonder, thankfulness, and appreciation for life. I want to invite you to say a little more about that and why you begin there.
Yes. I would like first to add to your generous comments about my life and work with the reflection that the work that we connect, which is a term we give to the interactive group work that has grown up over the last 35 years. And it's in essence about truth speaking. Sometimes I even think of it and did from the outset as a form of satyagraha, truth force, because the essence of this interactive experiential work is that everybody gets a chance to hear the person they most need to hear, and that's their own inner voice. So the work is constructed in a way where we get a chance to listen to ourselves. And we listen to ourselves and to each other, so it's essentially interactive and collective, in a journey through a spiral, we call it. And this spiral of the work has four stations. And what Terry was just now inviting us to attend to is the first station of this spiral, where we begin with gratitude and to get in the habit of wherever we are, whatever we're doing, to come from gratitude. And in the process, I have learned that this giving thanks, or this sense of awe and wonder at even being alive, being here in this incredible self-organizing universe of tremendous growing complexity and intricacy of beauty, that is just awe-inspiring, and that is the beginning of every single major religion and indigenous spiritual path, is that wow, that basic awe. And we can turn to that at any time and find that it is not dependent on external circumstances. We can get in the habit of being grateful that we are right now, that I, sitting in my kitchen looking out at a darkened sky over the Pacific, am talking with you, Terry Patton, and that there are unknown numbers of people listening in, and that we all care about what's happening to our planet. That's why we're giving ourselves this time, this moment together. So just at any point you can feel, and that we have the technology at the moment to do that, and that we have taken choice. There's certainly many other things you could have done with your life, Terry, but you've chosen to do this. So you can let yourself be kind of surprised, astonished, delighted, thrilled, whatever, over and over again. And what this does is give you a sense of that it's your birthright to be here, that it's enough to be here. And in so doing, as we become, get more and more in the habit of this, and the Aboriginal people of this continent are wonderful teachers in this, aren't they? Mm. My goodness, the Native Americans have built those Thanksgiving words, what they call the words that come before all else, so deeply into their culture. And that has given me encounter with them, strengthened my backbone around learning this. And when we do, what's great is I used to think that it was somewhat sentimental and a kind of, you know, Pollyanna-like to, oh, looking on the bright side and see the silver lining, and it's a little sentimental and so sweet, until I realized more and more that this is politically subversive. It is a revolutionary act to be thankful for your life and for what you are and what you have at this moment. Because the engine that drives late capitalism is the engine of creating dissatisfaction, building craving. You're not enough. You'll never be enough. You don't look right. You don't drive the right kind of car. You don't wear the right kind of clothes. You don't smell right. Your hair is a mess, et cetera, et cetera. This is the message we're given all the time by the multi-billion-dollar industries that depend upon our dissatisfaction to keep on buying their products. Isn't that so?
Yes.
So we find that this innocuous seeming activity is really a revolutionary act.
You know, that really strikes me. I love what you're saying, and yet I'm so aware that many people who have a pretty traditional worldview, practicing fundamentalists, Christians.
You mean a conventional worldview?
Yeah, you might call it. Yes, right.
Yeah, because I was just talking about the Earth traditions.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
In some lexicons, it can be called traditional, but I think you're right. That's a better way of looking at it, conventional worldview. We'll also really appreciate this virtue of gratitude, but I think you're maybe distinguishing a more radical and revolutionary and conscious choice of a more fundamental life disposition from a kind of gratitude that may presume a more childish relationship to God. Is that...
Well, that's always evolving in it, isn't it? Yeah. So that I suppose a more childish relationship to God could also have a lot of gimme, gimme, gimme in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the unceasing petitionary prayers. But all in the tradition in which I grew up, Christianity and Judaism too, which is a very strong sense of all the blessings given to us, the first act in the service is thanksgiving.
Right. So in that way, we unite really across all kinds of worldviews with something that's really universal to our humanity.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah, and it is also such a sort of spanks us awake to the power of each moment when we use it actually in our own personal lives, when we're so easy to get sucked into complaint when things aren't going just the way we want them, or there's sudden reversals, and some big ones too, to train the mind to just stop and breathe. Well, my gosh, I'm breathing. Thank God I can breathe. Mm-hmm. I have air to breathe. I have someone right here that I can turn and look at. Oh, you know, I'm being held to the earth by this sweet, strong power of gravity. You know, you can at any moment use it, of course, in very universal feelings of connection with people, but also just to bring yourself awake to what is in a given moment.
Right. The here and now in the most basic way.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And so that we, in the work that Reconnects, we give people opportunities right away and to speak, and to then interact, go outdoors, interact with the natural world in a way that evokes a sense of surprise and wonder. And there's so many ways that we can. At a workshop last week with young people of color, we started out by evoking their ancestors in their own cultural tradition and the gift, the thanksgiving they felt, despite all the pain and the humiliation and the marginalization that comes from the way our dominant culture treats their ethnicity now. They stop to think of their ancestors, and gratitude arises. This was so strong and so sweet, and helps us feel being held. Yeah. So it's not just me, like a pea in a shoebox, batting around, essentially lonely in this busy, over-busy world, but I'm held, and there's a long line of ancestors that's right at my back.
Yeah, beautiful. So having begun with gratitude, we, in the work that reconnects you, then draw people into what, when I first encountered in your work, this incredible contribution, your fierce teaching about the profoundly deep and transformative and self-intimate process of acknowledging and feeling and honoring our pain and fear and caring regarding.
Yeah. And I think that that's really incredibly crucial part of our work, and it's sort of in a way the hinge on which the work turns. It's the most countercultural because the dominant society would have us be silent, obedient, and around what we feel is soul destroying about what's happening to our world at this point, what's happening to our brothers and sisters, what's happening to our the other species, what's happening to the water, to the air, what's happening to the forest, what's happening to our food, the extinction rates, what's happening to the very chemistry of our atmosphere, what's happening to the climate, so that there's this actual accelerating, compounding, interweaving of destructive forces now. And it is still, in spite of all that, it is still, there's a cultural taboo against really talking about it. But you feel, and I can still feel that. I can feel free in a workshop, but you talk about this socially, passing the time of day with friends and neighbors or people at work, and you hesitate. You're looked at as a depressed person and a depressing person, and it slips very easily into argument. Well, what would you have us do? Do you think that we should, have a draconian dictatorship that should tell it blah, 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 so that even if you speak your grief or your anger or your fear, that is threatening, and the culture has learned how to keep us quiet by very successfully persuading us that this is an evidence of personal neurotic situation, personal neurosis, so that the culture has by and large been very effective in persuading us that our sense of alarm and concern and grief for the world and our brother sister beings is to reduce that to the separate ego, to the private. So it becomes viewed as a private maladjustment, and you can't, were there drugs for it? Oh boy, are there not drugs for it. There's a whole pharmacy closet there for us to address the feelings of despair and depression that come up. And there is a whole army of psychotherapeutic trained people who can, more and more therapists, of course, are, and I'm sure you know a lot, that are waking up to the legitimacy and the actual significance, importance of our feeling, our pain for the world. But you also know that over the last couple of generations, this has been treated as a kind of private craziness, and it's kept people shut up.
Right.
People shut up and shut down. So it's sort of like, what was that, Jim Hillman's wonderful book, 100 Years of Psychotherapy, and the world is getting worse and worse.
Yeah.
Because he made the same connection that we have decided that that's a personal problem rather than a collective challenge for us all to talk about and do something about.
You know, that's really the source of this whole series. Is I even quoted that book title by Hillman.
Really? Did you?
Yeah, to say, look, we've had all these years of spiritual practice, and something wonderful is at the core of it. Let's not by no means disrespect, but how do we have hope that we're going to break through to a different story if we just keep doing what we've been doing since ancient times? How does spiritual practice, how does higher consciousness evolve, and how do we engage it in new ways if we're really to rise to meet these challenges? Let's ask those questions. Let's talk about this. So I feel like you're such a hero in being, you know, a like-spirited being who wants to have the forbidden conversation. A tremendous intimacy arises when we admit these things and speak in
absolutely
a real way.
Yeah. That they're and you know, people know when they are coming to join a group doing the work that Reconnects, they know that's in store. So they come already eager to be able to spill the beans, to talk openly and frankly at last without embarrassment. Without any shame, without any hiding, what they see happening and what it feels like. It is such a liberation. And, well, just as gratitude is a revolutionary act in terms of the political economy, you can sure believe that this is too.
Mm-hmm.
Because the dominant political economy depends on our agreement. And at least if we don't, at least we have to be silent. I remember that whole message so beautifully conveyed in a young activist in Australia, Benny Sable, who would show up at different big demonstrations and actions, and he would be clad in a black wetsuit and with a death mask and written in white on the back and front of this wetsuit as he stood there on top of cans marked radioactive, consume, obey, be silent, die. Those four commandments, one over the other. Consume, be silent, obey, be silent, die. So to get together and often we use rituals as a container for this, but to speak the truth of your experience, the truth of what you see and feel and know is happening to your world. It's a sacred act. And that truth speaking, when you bring out what you had been hiding, then suddenly it becomes, swings open the doors to the separate ego, and it becomes like interstitial tissue binding us all, and suddenly we find that we are walking out into a commonality of shared experience. And you're right, I love that you use the word intimacy that arises then.
You know, it seems to me that as I've done this, something similar in my own work with people and done it even with myself and with close students, that the deeper voyage first is intimacy with myself, that there's a courage that it takes to speak it to others is powerful, and we are a tremendous gift. You know, we help and catalyze one another. We're social creatures. All of that's really important in the we, but there's a lot of denial that's just built into our relationship with ourselves. It's the taboo is not only socially imposed, it's internally structured too.
That's interesting. I think I may be less aware of that than you, because I, in this work, see people so ready to. But I think that's because people have self-selected in coming to the work. You wouldn't come to the work if you hadn't already decided you wanted to do that, maybe.
Yeah, there's I mean, crossing that river of denial is a big portage.
Yeah, but I suppose if you're talking about someone carrying a lot of responsibility in, I've been learning a lot about Goldman Sachs, because our city here of Oakland is millions and millions of dollars in debt to Goldman Sachs for a swap deal, and it's that's happening in many cities. Sorry. So say you are sitting as a CEO of British Petroleum or Shell or Goldman Sachs, or that at then the acknowledgement of the pain would be censored within yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That the denial would be one that's internal, not just keeping silent not to offend other people.
Yeah.
This
honoring of one's pain is also a voyage, though. I mean, people can feel it, but to honor it is another move.
Yeah, to honor it, to befriend it. Just the opposite of paving it over and explaining it away. And it's shattering. It shatters the conventional mores, but even if it isn't as dramatic as what I just experienced this week with the young people of color, which was probably the most intense experience I can remember, encountering their so clearly expressed pain that. I forget what I was about to say, but we find that when we are bold. Oh, I know it can. What I was about to say was, it can be quite quiet. There can be somebody without any evident emotion, very stolidly sitting there talking. In the practices that we've evolved, and what they have are seeing is that they don't need to be afraid of speaking the truth of their experience. You don't need to cathart, and indeed, this section of the work, the honoring our pain for the world, it's not about catharsis. It's not about the intensity of expression, because the grief, well, you can't purge yourself of it, because it'll arise the very next day.
Yeah.
You get up again in the morning, and then you listen to the news and hear what's happening with the climate deliberations in Doha, or you can hear what's happening with the police departments acquiring new drones, or you can, if whatever. And then it begins again, so that we are not purging ourselves of the pain. We are becoming strong to face it and not be afraid of it, and here, the key point, to recognize it for what it is. And we reframe this pain as our capacity to suffer with our world. And when we, it's just the opposite of being reduced to some private pathology. If you honor your pain for the world, you see that this is, in essence, it's a capacity to feel the pain of the world, to suffer with the world. And that is the literal meaning of compassion. This is proof positive of the fact that you're a compassionate being. It's proof positive of our interconnectedness, so that what we had kept hidden, that pain for the world, turns into a doorway, and we walk through it and find ourselves in this vast and vibrant web of life that's become very real for us. Because our pain for the world is not based in private craziness, but it grows out of caring, and that caring grows out of our deep-rooted interconnectedness with all that is, which is central, of course, to your own work and teaching, Terry.
Yeah. Well, this is very rich. It seems maybe this is a moment perhaps to talk about how out of that voyage through gratitude and honoring our pain, we can see with new eyes.
Well, in the very process, so the next station in the spiral is one that we have come to call seeing with new eyes. In the very act of truth speaking, we find that our connectedness with all life, turning to face our fear, we meet the warrior who waits within. Turning to acknowledge our aloneness, we gain the embrace of the universe. Turning to speak our anger and outrage over conditions, we recognize our passion for justice. So this journey of honoring the pain ushers us into a basic shift in identity where we move from the walls of the separate, isolated self kind of dissolve, and we find ourselves experiencing wider reaches, widening circles of our caring and even of our identity. So here in this part of the spiral of the work that reconnects, we draw from deep ecology. We draw from systems theory. We draw from spiritual teachings. And you can draw from any of these traditions. Because I'm in Buddhist practice, I find, you know, I draw a lot from that. You know, because it's a very, so many practical methods there. But you can turn to any spiritual path, whether it's Sufi or Jewish or Hindu or Taoist, and you can find that this has been the spiritual journey for the people of our planet to move into wider reaches of our caring and even to our identity. So it becomes almost a mystical knowing of our inter-existence, or as Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, our interbeing. So we do this with deep time work. We do it with things like the Council of All Beings, where we just step aside from our human identity and let another life form speak through us. All of these have tremendous impact, but they're also have a lot of laughter and delight in them as well. We enter the play, the playful nature of the universe. And because it's always something of a joke when we take off our persona, which literally means our mask of the role that we're playing, and open up to our essential, our mutual belonging. And always there, there's a laughter of relief. Isn't that so?
Mm-hmm. It's actually so essential in a way that, especially in the context of, you know, I think there are levels of kind of horror and there's an aspect of the work that is tremendously serious. And
absolutely.
Yeah, to discover humor in the midst of that profound gravity is critical to our psycho-spiritual health in the midst of it. It seems to me maybe one of the most important quantities of the work is for those to somehow co-enliven us.
Yeah. I have never, and I, you know, I didn't start into this work until I was nearing 50 and my late 40s, and I never anticipated that I'd be doing something that engaged in an activity that would allow me to see the size and the beauty of the human heart as this has.
Mm.
And there is, and I would never have imagined that speaking our pain for the world would also give birth to a hilarity that seems as intense as the grief was.
Hmm.
It's a recognition. You know, you find your home. When you find your home, there's such relief that you have to laugh that you thought you were lost.
Yeah.
And you thought you were forever doomed. And you thought you were forever stuck with these feelings of isolation and inadequacy. And suddenly, simply the act of naked, sheer, or desperate, or whatever, sharing that you suddenly find yourself, that you're home and you've been home all the time. And so you have to laugh at that.
And maybe even again and again, because in some ways it shows new facets, that there's a kind of laughter, not just in the first encounter with this work, but in the re-inhabiting of the paradoxes of our...
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. No, you never do it once and for all. For one thing, the messages of the culture were so conditioned.
Yeah.
By our culture, our language, our education, the institutions, to see ourselves as separate, competitive individuals, to need to control, to need to show off, to need to be approved, and da 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 da. That to have convincing argument that we're all one, or that you have one great Satori experience, or the spirit epiphany of our mutual, you know, belonging, is enough, because we're out moving around in a society that we have habitual ways of responding in situations. So you have to. That's why spiritual practice is a practice. That's why you do this over and over. And then, it's kind of neat that way, isn't it?
It really is.
It keeps you.
Well, if we weren't in this dynamic relationship to things, we would, the humility that is the empty cup that can be filled by the grace of God wouldn't be necessary, and therefore somehow the getting down on one's knees seems to me to be, you know, that's always the price of Dante going from the inferno to purgatory.
Yeah.
And it's really that gesture, like the fact that I need to do that again and again and again, is what makes it, what gives you access to me. If I weren't doing that, I would be some way immune. The intimacy.
Yeah, well, you
even,
wouldn't be. Yeah, you would. You wouldn't be alive in the world I inhabit.
Right.
Yeah, it's lovely to talk with you, Terry, about this work. Makes me realize how much I love it. And so we go through that, and we have more time for it, you know, when we get together for 10 days or then when we get together for a day. But and then there's that we move on to that fourth station in the spiral of the work that reconnects, which we call the going forth. And it's the where we look at what we've harvested from the three previous, from our journey so far, and how we want to apply that in our own lives. And we turn and we look at our own day-to-day lives and our own communities and our own workplace and our own opportunities and our own relations, and get a clearer, turn the lens a little bit and get a clearer picture of what it is that we most want to do, and that what and it could be something we're already doing, and oh, and I can bring in this person and I can align with that, and this is the next step I want to take. So that is the fourth stage.
Now, a lot of people, in fact, great teachers, some of the guests on this program, Jean Houston in particular, has focused a lot of her work on helping people to understand their life purpose, which is a aspect of this going forth. And in the context of that kind of contemplation, there's a desire to know, you know, what are my unique gifts? How can I be effective? Where does my deep yearning meet the hunger of the world? And all of that would seem to me to be perhaps part of this going forth, not just the...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we have, in this regard, in the last years, my appreciation for role of intention, and particularly a particular kind of intention. This is the intention that arises within us to respond to the needs of the world, to act for the welfare of all beings. And in our last book, Active Hope, my co-author and I, he's not in Buddhist practice, but he decided, yes, I want to keep these two Buddhist terms in the book, even though the book is not limited, you know, just for Buddhists. But there don't seem to be words in English for the meanings caught in two words. One is bodhisattva, which is the person within each of us who knows our deep interbeing, who knows that there is no private salvation, that if we're going to wake up, we're going to have to wake up together, who knows that deep, deep dependent co-rising. That was the key teaching of the Lord Buddha. And this is the one who also has this intention, and we kept it called bodhicitta, which we kept that word too in this non-Buddhist book for non-Buddhist people. We kept that term because as yet there isn't an English term quite like that. It's intention, yes, but a particular dimension of a particular kind of intention. It's the intention for the healing of our world, an intention for the welfare of all beings. And it's it's very exciting to me to see how in our moment, this moment that we are living now, Terry, it seems that there is such an upwelling of this kind of intention, this kind of motivation. It's so beautifully attested to in Paul Hawkins' book, Blessed Unrest, where he talks about the millions of grassroots organizations and the many, many, many millions of people who are working at the grassroots for the survival of life on this complex life forms on this planet, working for fairness, for justice in every culture around the world. Sometimes you can see them on Bill McKibben's 350.org website when they have worldwide actions, and you see people in every country doing something to often quite joyously, sometimes humorously, to show how involved they are in working for climate change, to deal with climate change. So this intention, so I'm right with you on that. We can take this bodhicitta, sometimes it, and maybe you feel this too, it's like something you can count on, something that you can ride like a vehicle, you know, it's right there. And
and it's bigger than me, you know, it's like some greater intentionality that may have even brought me into being is flowing through me.
Yes. Yeah. So this is my hope, that this is what fosters, what makes me glad to get up in the morning, and which when my spirits sag with the news, I turn and feel, that makes me sad because I want so much. And so I bless the wanting for us to be able to respond, say, as a government to the needs for targets and regulations around emissions controls, and also gratitude for all the people who are trying, gratitude for the people who are reporting the news, gratitude for the news channels that are bringing it, gratitude that there's that caring out there, gratitude that I give a shit, that,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm. Sometimes for me, the fact that we live at this particular moment in time, this time when you've probably heard Barbara Marx Hubbard's beautiful phrase that we're the eyes of evolution in some way, you know, just in our lifetimes, this amazing orbiting telescope has given us these images that have told us the age of our universe, and we've seen far reaches of our universe in a way that was never possible before, and we can see the stitching together of that evolution of the cosmos with the evolution of life on this planet, and the evolution of human beings, and then the evolution of human culture and noetic and cultural evolution, and we can see how it's accelerated and accelerated and accelerated, and the unfolding of cultural evolution even now, even though in some ways there's certainly some pathologies at work and that are, you know, exactly what we're talking about, but there's something glorious at work too. And we're here in this interstitial place where it's as if evolution, the cosmos has been wanting to become complex and interconnected and conscious enough to see itself, and it just now is, and we are its eyes seeing itself with a new level of granularity, absolutely unprecedented, right at a time when another level of cooperation and consciousness is needed in order for us to keep the game going and to be alive at a moment like that, and have the opportunity to attempt to be the healthy response and the healthy participation it gives me goosebumps, you know. It's so ennobling.
Yes, yeah, that's it. you express it so beautifully. And so there we go again. There's gratitude.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, and it's, thank you for letting me share about the nature of this work and how grateful I am that you are doing what you're doing, Terry, at a time when two things are happening. There's both this evolutionary awakening, but at the same time, and you know it, there's what David Corton calls the Great Unraveling, and that's happening at an accelerating pace, too.
Yeah.
So we are asked to be super aware with our open eyes and open heart and open mind at a time when not only can we see the excitement of our being able to look back through time and fulfill the promise of consciousness, but also at a time when cultures are being lost and languages are disappearing and the lungs of the planet are being bulldozed and the oceans are being poisoned and turned radioactive. So this great unraveling is what we need to look at equally, don't you think?
Yeah, it is the looking at the deep at this great unraveling is an interesting koan, because I see people, really wonderful people who I've been in dialogue with in this series, who don't really want to spend as much time looking at that, but who are simply focused in a very real way on process of waking up in a fundamental way to you might say the Buddhist, you know, the fundamental spiritual teachings. And then others like Andrew Harvey, who really bring a tremendous amount of emotion into it, so that, you know, he would emphasize the importance of just weeping, you know, with tears for the way that the mother is being raped, you know,
and to raise the emotional
temperature even.
Take, for example, something that's happening very fast across the country, and particularly to my state in California right now, but it's all been all over the mountain states, and that's hydrofracking for natural gas.
Right.
And this is spreading like a pox across the land. And thanks to agreements under Vice President Cheney, there is absolutely no way to even find out what the chemicals are that are being used, let alone control them. And that was exempt from the Clean Water Act. And here we have companies all over the place sinking these mile-deep wells and pumping down through their horizontal place these waters with hundreds of chemicals that to explode the confines and bring out the natural gas. And the chemicals stay down there, and they're contaminating our water for, not for tomorrow, not for next year, not for the next generation, but forever. And there's no way to get it out. So when I talk about opening to the great unraveling, I'm not talking about how much you cry, but I'm talking about having, along with the evolution of your higher consciousness, enough downright caring to act with your brothers and sisters to see what you can do to stop it.
Right. To be actually engaged in political or
Absolutely.
Social or other action.
Otherwise, your spiritual practice is cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And it leads to, I don't know what kind of serenity or equanimity you can get there if you wall off the knowledge of and don't have the caring enough to find it out. Now, if you really don't know, that's one thing. But I think it's a spiritual practice to find out and know what's happening to your world.
To be related. It's a sphere of our existence. You know, I teach integral spiritual practice, and one of the ways I express that is to talk about the spheres of our practice. We do body practices. We do spirit practices. We do practices with the mind and with our psyche and our deep emotion, but we also do practices in our relationships, and we have to practice as citizens of all the communities we're a part of, in relationship to all, you know, to all our relations, as the American Aboriginals, Native Americans put it, and being related to our larger circumstance does involve, you know, at least voting, much more than that, though, really participating, because if there is no responsibility in the chair where you sit, where is there?
Yep.
And that sense that that's a dimension of practice, and that everybody's got a unique expression. It's not like everybody has to be as much of an activist as our caricature of what an activist is. We don't have to have a rigid picture of what activism is, but a sense of responsibility and participation seems to me to be just part of accepting our relations.
Otherwise, you're half dead.
If you can let
your country be, or the land that you're, the part of the earth that you've been born at the time when you're living on it, be despoiled for all future generations to come, then what does it matter how, what spiritual practices you've done in whatever spheres? What does it matter if you have let on your watch the earth be permanently contaminated?
Now, this cycle that we've just traveled together of gratitude and honoring our pain and seeing with new eyes and going forth is something you've described as being, this work is like a fractal pattern. Once you've really, really engaged with it, and you would engage it maybe in a rich way over 10 days or over one day, or, you know, the way we've gone through it here is just an hour.
And you find it happening in your personal life. So you're right. I'm glad you noted that it has a fractal nature. It's
and
very
that,
dynamic.
That fractal nature means that it's always playing through us. Like, it might play through us in a moment. It might play through us across a day or across a certain...
I like that. Yes, beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that.
That I might need to reawaken to gratitude and to honoring my pain and to seeing that there's something universal and foundational about this spiral form.
That's right, because I think that you can see the dynamics of other spiritual traditions right in that. That's certainly true for my biblical roots. But I'm so happy to hear you emphasize its dynamic nature and the fact that it's working through us. And more you come to be able to recognize that our caring is the earth caring through us. Our thinking when we're really engaged is like the earth thinking through us. So that this is this bodhicitta, this being motivated for the healing of the world, you find that you're like a synapse, or you're like a neuron in a neural net in which is a greater life is pulsing through you. It's beautiful. It's like grace. You know, in my root tradition of Christianity, grace is such a lovely concept. Usually you think of it as something God, coming from God through you. But now we find that it's coming from the earth through us and from other beings through us and from other people through us.
Omnidirectional, natural omnidirectional worship. That's my, my joking church is the Church of Now, N-O-W, natural omnidirectional worship.
Oh, I've got to remember that. Can I join?
Yes, absolutely. This is a virtual baptism. Wonderful. Well, this is the time when I take a break and make a few important announcements. And the first one is I want to make sure that people know about how to find out more about your work. Joanna's website is joannamacy.net, joannamacy.net. And you can learn more about her work there. It's very, very rich. There's a lot there. There's a lot of rich resources on the work that reconnects, on the Great Turning, on engaged Buddhism, on deep ecology.
Systems theory.
General systems theory. And
nuclear guardianship.
Right. Nuclear guardianship. Also practices, training opportunities, poems, letters. There's a lot there. And so I highly recommend that. That's joannamacy.net. And you can also read her books. And her most recent book, Active Hope, is...
I give the subtitle.
Okay. I have to...
No, I'll say it. Because
say
I wanted
it
to be the title. Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy.
Yeah. That's great. I highly recommend that. But she has written many other really, really wonderful books, a dozen of them. Thinking Like a Mountain. I should be looking at the list of them all.
World is Lover, World is Self.
Yes.
Coming Back to Life. And Coming Back to Life has a lot of practices.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of the how-to of the work that reconnects in groups.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Then my memoir, Widening Circles, because I've lived a long time and I had a very lively life.
Yeah, great. And there are some others that the Year with Rilke kind of is a lovely group of readings that you've selected.
And two books of poetry of Rilke's that my co-translator, Anita Barrows, and I translated, especially the Book of Hours.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Well, thank you for this plug.
All of that, and so I want to make sure you're aware of all that. Additionally, I want to make sure that you're aware of some of my own offerings. You can connect with me and be able to find out more about all my activities and sign up for my mailing list, which is different from the Beyond Awakening list, which you may already be on, by visiting terrypatten.com. terrypatten.com. It's a brand new website, and I encourage you to go there and sign up for my mailing list, and I'll send you a free audio, a guided meditation when you do. I'll be teaching in Switzerland, Germany, Norway, and Sweden in late January and the first half of February this year. You can find out about that. And the website also will soon have a blog post that summarizes my current activism project, which is at a different website, integralobama.com. Some of you know I created a grassroots fundraising effort to help reelect President Obama, and now we're involved in bringing integral and evolutionary policy proposals to bear to try to influence the administration. As supporters, we hope we've bought a little bit of their attention and we can perhaps have some influence. So please stay on the line. At the end of this call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up, and we'll complete. But what I want to do now is invite questions. So if you're dialed in on the phone and you'd like to offer a question or a comment or just participate in this rich dialogue, press 1 on your telephone keypad. And if you're dialed in, if you're listening by computer, please type in your questions. And we actually have room for more questions, so I want to invite them. The first one comes from Jan in Frederick, who asks, it's a deceptively simple question, it's actually rather deep, how do we take that step to get the greater life pulsing through us?
How do we take that step to open to the greater life in us?
Yeah.
Oh, well, to quote Rumi, I think there are 1,000 ways to nail and kiss the ground. You could look at your hand and see the whole story of the universe in your hand, that every particle and every atom and every molecule and every cell of that hand goes back through billions of years. Or you can listen to the prayers of your heart, or you can see, let your life take in the, listen to what feel, what hurts the heart, what squeezes the heart when you hear about, when you think about what's happening to what we're doing to our world. There are just so many things. What do you say, Terry?
Well, let me lean into that. One of the things that seems to me to be really, really important here is that the greater life is already here in us. And what I do is I notice the fact that there are all kinds of habits that are culturally reinforced and that are just there in my own habit energy that are squeezing it down so that that greater life comes through only sometimes just as a trickle, and that the incredible, you know, radiance of being only comes through at about 20 watts. And so noticing the way in which it's being squeezed down, noticing the places where I'm afraid or the places where I'm hiding from myself, hiding from fear, hiding from depression, hiding from bad feeling, trying to control, cramping it down. When I just see that and I meet that with compassion and I notice that that greater life is kind of waiting, it's ready to pulse through me more. And I also see those around me or the world, where I see what I love, whether it's the natural world or other human beings, and I notice that if I let myself be, I'm a circuitry of connection for that greater life to find its way to those that I love. And then it just does it for me. I can't really do it because I think I should or I want to for myself, but it's just like the small, you know, 120-pound woman who can lift a car off her child. When you care, it comes through you, and so that caring connection really lets it flow, I think. Does that resonate for you, Joanna?
Oh, yeah. For me, I mean, it's different for different people, but in the hour before I joined you, Terry, on this broadcast, I was at a market and needed to get home. I wanted to be sure to be here at the time you set. And I stepped out of doors, and I felt the fresh air, and I craved it. So I dropped every other thing I was going to do and took time to go down to the bay and stood there in the wind and the sun was just setting, and it was sparkling on the water, and I just let myself be bathed quite literally in the beautiful air and smells and sights, and I gave thanks. I thought, I'm part of this. I can see this sun. This is my sun. This is the beautiful water. So I let go of practical things, and then I hurried back here, and I was back in time for this program.
Well, thank you. That was a wonderful, I think you brought the energy of that greater life that you took in through that nature communion right into our conversation.
Oh, that's good, because I've been feeling it still.
Yeah.
I felt some of my energy in this conversation with you is thanks to that sun on the water.
Yeah, yeah. Beautiful. Well, good. So if you have questions, please press 1 on your telephone keypad to raise your hand if you're calling in by phone, or type them into the window on the page on your computer. Here's another question. Jen in Guelph, in Ontario,
yeah,
asks if the work that Reconnects is being used in schools with young people.
Oh, well, yes, but not in all I know about that is anecdotal. I know that up in Ontario, and particularly around Guelph, which is such a forward-looking place with its transition movement, that there are people bringing the work that Reconnects into their churches, into their school, in their classrooms, into their psychotherapy hours. But I only know about this anecdotally. But I do know that this is something that core assumption and attitudes that this builds are very, very easy to transfer and use in other settings. So, Jim and Guelph, try it.
It's Jen, yeah. Okay,
Jen.
Good. I resonate with that. Now, I'm sorry, I just misstated. It's star 2 that you need to press to raise your hand. I just said 1, but it's star 2 if you're calling in on the phone. Okay. We have another question about young people. Actually, this is something I wanted to get into you in some depth, Joanna. This is from a woman in her 60s who sort of awoke in her 50s, who asks if you have any thoughts about how to influence younger folks. And I'm curious, too, generationally. I know that my generation, the boomers, really cared a lot. We had a lot of idealism, and then it seemed that the generation that followed was more more conventional or more self-interested. And the new millennials, there's quite a few that are very involved, the folks that have been participating in the Occupy movement. But there's other social observers who think that this new generation is kind of too cool to be as passionately idealistic, that they sometimes call them, you know, postmodern whatever generation. They're sort of overwhelmed by the complexity and difficulty of their world and maybe not as willing to put their hearts on the line. How do you see the generational dynamic?
Well,
I'm really curious.
I think there's huge variations, so that I'm sure it's true that there's a closing down from a Me Too attitude, because the materialism of our culture is very deep, and it's and people are so focused on their gadgets that it's hard for them to take in anything else, the young people sometimes. But the young people that I see are so wide awake, and I've been doing workshops with young people in movement that's called Generation Waking Up. And sometimes they call it Gen Up for short. But they have, and they're some of, they're in, loosely connected with the Pachamama organization with their Awakening the Dreamer presentations, which are global by now, to help acquaint people with
Josh Gorman is
part of
that.
So I'm, and I also teach to graduate schools here a seminary at Graduate Theological Union and California Institute of Integral Studies.
Gosh, something got buzzy on your line, Joanna.
Oh.
Are you aware of what that might be?
No.
Okay, that's clearer again. Thank you.
Okay. Well, it's just that I happen to be in touch with young people of incredible beauty and immediacy, and they're quite bold. Some of them are going on the gift economy. They see that our subservience to money is producing inequality and corrosive to the heart and mind. And so they're stepping outside it. So I just love seeing the imagination and energy of these young people, and I'm so glad. I've been raising money for, and those who come to my website will be invited, just for scholarships for young people, because this work is something that they can do, that they love, and that they can find their own authority. We have, as I like to say, one of the most important things we can do, whatever our age is from our birth certificate, we all need to act our age. And that age is what? You think of it as your age is Gaia? Well, that's 4 billion years. Or your age is this universe, 13.7 billion years, because every part of our composition goes back through time. Everything. You've evoked it yourself. So it's time that we acted our age, and that we're not just taking action out of some personal whim or nobility, but that out of our authority of as speaking part of Earth, speaking for Earth, speaking for our universe, speaking for the self-organizing potential of open systems, which have created our universe.
You know, I so when you
I can't hear you now.
You can't hear me?
But you just went. You've just gone very faint.
Really? Okay, let's try this. I bet that works.
Better.
Okay. Thank you for letting me know. So when you see the ways in which some young people are a little absorbed in their gadgets and not as connected, do you have some sense of how this work that reconnects can be shaped or delivered in a way that crosses the barriers that seem to... You know, one of the things that I hear a lot from people my age and older is this sense of alarm or frustration about how to reach younger people more dynamically. And when I talk with younger people, they're interested to organize their own generation, and even they express some frustration at the limits of the levels of commitment and interest and
of their own generation.
Of their own generation, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm wondering if you've reflected on that, and you know, because it's obviously so important to our efficacy, especially at this time.
Mm-hmm. Well, everything that we've been talking about is something that can directly help a young person find a sense of meaning. And I think for the we underestimate the what a young person can do. I have been very influenced by a community organizing movement in Sri Lanka called the Sarvodaya Movement, Everybody Wakes Up. It's active in 15,000 villages. And in my time out there with them, I saw how the importance they gave to working with children and young people. There's no age too young, and that they expect a lot in the village organizing from the young people, that they can be trusted with a lot. I think that after I came back from working with Sarvodaya, I began to think, gee, maybe we should put our postal service in the hands of high school students. You know, we could, there's so much more. We could give them, dignify them with giving them projects and enlisting them in work for our world, for restoration work at almost at every level of what needs to be done could be work that could be entrusted to at some major parts of it to engaging young people. And then they could find experience firsthand the adventure and the enjoyment of working together instead of just sitting at their laptop and being right. a couch potato.
Right. Well, thank you. We have several people who've raised their hand, and I want to give them a chance to raise their voices. So there are two people, unfortunately, I can't distinguish who are anonymous. They may be calling in on Skype. I've just opened your mic. One of you, please speak up and introduce yourself. Hello? Okay. I'm going to try the other person here. We've got two of them, so if that one isn't speaking. Hello, you're on
the air. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. Terry, this is Dan Siegel calling.
Oh, wonderful.
Nice to hear this. And Joanna, it's been fantastic to listen to the two of you have this dialogue. And
is this Dan Siegel of Oakland?
It's another Dan Siegel down in Los Angeles.
Oh.
This
is Dr. Dan Siegel, who I interviewed on this series, who's brilliant.
I'm a fan of yours.
Well, I'm a fan of yours and of Terry's, so this is a fan club meeting. So it's been a beautiful conversation, and I guess the one question I want to just raise, and I look forward to future conversations about this, is what do you think in this setting of a world where culture encourages this, you know, what Einstein called the optical delusion of our separateness, when the culture is so reinforcing that and the competition encouraged in schools reinforces that, the idea of race to the top, you know, like we're supposed to beat each other up to get somewhere instead of collaboration, which we evolved to really have, what do you think parents can do to deal with the cultural messages and educational messages that keep on reinforcing this delusion that the self is embodied in a skin rather than the self is this plural verb where we're all truly interconnected? What can a parent do to help a child not fall prey to those messages from schools and the larger culture?
Well, my own point of view is that the parent can do more by the example of their life than by preaching. So that if when a child sees his or her parents involved in community responsibilities and activities, worked with, and there's so many different kinds, but and often, you know, working in a community garden together, or going to refurbish re-insulate an abandoned house together, or going to an Occupy meeting together, going on whatever, that I think that that shows that the example of the parents is hugely important, don't you think?
Absolutely. So living that interconnected truth and showing that to the kids.
Yeah, I think that matters more to them than the kinds of... Then also there's the encouragement that can be given to the children, and certain opportunities that can be, they could be directed to, that are just for their own age bracket.
Mm-hmm.
That there are projects. I don't know, for example, you're down in Los Angeles, but the whole tree people thing and Andy Lifkin's work in the neighborhoods, there's, I know that that has involved young people.
Absolutely.
And so that, or to, you know, direct the kids off to nature, a time in a group thing in nature, on the, you know, like Outward Bound or something of that, doesn't need to be that expensive, but that can... put them on their own or with their peers in the natural world to build up a sense of independence from mediated culture and into raw contact with the natural world, with danger, with their own sense of timing, with their own capacity to be tired and hungry and thirsty. You know, that kind of meeting your limits and feeling wonderful about yourself as you do that. I know that that's been transformative with kids in my family.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's beautiful.
Dan, I'm curious. You have, you know, you're quite an expert on attachment theory and interpersonal neurobiology. I wonder if you're asking this question from a place of a current inquiry in yourself that you might share more about.
Well, sure. Well, first of all, I think, you know, Joanna, your work has been just so inspirational. And Tara, you're really bringing this idea out. And, you know, I think the message of the self, you know, the S-E-L-F, is so interesting, because even in attachment research that you're talking about, Terry, that, you know, we talk about the development of the self or the interpersonal world of the self, even like the self needs to be within your body. And in attachment research, it's just looked at in this fundamental way as, okay, the baby's born and there's a self that needs to find what's called self-regulation in interactions with the parents, for example. So the whole assumption there is that there is a self that's separate. And I think in my own journey, you're asking about where I'm at with it, you know, the more I've come from being a scientist trained in that way of thinking, I mean, from biochemistry to attachment research, and now to looking at this larger issue of, you know, where we are on the planet. And the Garrison Institute, we do all this work in New York on climate change issues and its relationship to the mind. And so part of what we're trying to explore in that work is, you know, can we turn the materialistic way we're destroying the planet around by actually examining the inner truth of what a sense of self is? And if we can help get cultural messages out there through larger media forms or through schools or even through the intimate connections within a family of, in fact, the self being this, you know, I call it a plural verb, but the idea is, you know, this emerging, interconnected process of beingness, mm-hmm. you know, could we then maybe help climate change issues in this really deep foundational way that some people would call spiritual, if you use that word, of a larger interconnectedness, which is fine. But even from a scientific point of view, why can't the self be actually defined as interdependent, as a fundamental reality? Why does the word self have to get enclosed by the skin? So that's kind of what I've been wrestling with my students and colleagues, and, you know, and the things I'm just scientifically thinking about is, why does culture and family life continually reinforce that delusion, which is probably one of the fundamental sources of the dying of the planet,
mm-hmm.
you know? So,
well, I totally agree with you on that. And I have found that deep ecology, as well as Buddhism, has been really helpful here, and the notion of the ecological self and the practices like the Council of All Beings, where you can just take on playfully and seriously, be the voice of another part of the earth.
Yes.
And it brings with conviction and truth and beauty.
That's magnificent. And that truth and beauty, you know, if there's any little contribution I can offer, trained as a scientist, is that that's completely scientifically valid. And that it's not, we don't have to have a division now between, you know, political awakening, spiritual awakening, scientific awakening. They're converging on the same interdependent reality. You know, this is just the truth of our human lives. And so I think we're all trying to participate in whatever ways we can to contribute to this larger dialogue that needs to be this distributed conversation, you know, in all these realms of our lives.
Well, thank you, Dan. And Joanna, I want to turn to you and invite you. We're really at the end of our time, but if you would be able to help us bring this to a close with perhaps some poetry that you might care to recite, I think that would be a lovely way for us to...
Well, here's a short poem by Rilke that immediately relates to what Dan Siegel was saying about what we need to experience. So this is the first poem I ever read by writer Maria Rilke. It's in his Book of Hours that was written about 110 years ago. I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may not complete this last one, but I give myself to it. I've been circling around God, that primordial tower. I've been circling for thousands of years, and still I don't know. Am I a falcon, a storm, or a great song? What is yourself? Yourself then, dear Terry, dear Dan, and all participating. Are you a falcon, a storm, or a great song? We're so much bigger. We're so much bigger than the little bundle of self-concerns that our culture has helped us get stuck in. But we can step out of that. We can step out of it, and now's the time.
Beautiful. Well, thank you very much. I do want to mention, if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you're interested in learning more about Joanna's work, please visit joannamacy.net. You're also invited to go to terrypatton.com to look at my blog entries and sign up for my mailing list. And in about 5 weeks, early next year, at our regular time at 10 a.m. on Sunday, on January 13th, I'll be talking with the remarkable science journalist Lynn McTaggart, author of the best-selling books The Field, The Bond, and The Intention Experiment. Thank you so much for joining Joanna and me today. We can only open up part of the phone lines, but if you've called in on the phone, please speak up and say goodbye, and we'll all sign out. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
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 Bye. Bye. Bye. Thank you.
Wonderful. Okay.
And Terry, is there any way to get a recording of this program?
Absolutely. This will be downloadable, and I will send you the link. In fact, I'll call you now just privately so we can have a moment together.
Okay, good. Please. Thank you.
Thank you,
Dan. It was a thrill talking with you.
Yeah, wasn't that lovely? Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
The moderator has left the conference.